shock or annoyance. It took a few minutes for her to realize it was powdered sugar. They were in the kitchen, helping Mark as he put together plates of apples and cheese and donut sandwiches. Truly horrible concoctions involving donuts cut in half and filled with peanut butter, honey, and jelly. Kieran liked the honey, though. He licked some off his fingers and started to peel an apple with a small, sharp knife.
Wakala, Christina laughed. Gross. Wash your hands after you lick them.
We never wash our hands in the hunt, said Kieran, sucking honey from his finger in a way that made Christina's stomach feel fluttery.
That's true, we didn't, Mark agreed, slicing a donut in half and sending up another cloud of powdered sugar.
That's because you live like savages, said Christina. Go wash your hands.
She steered Kieran to the sink, whose taps still confused him, and went over to dust sugar off the back of Mark's shirt. He turned to smile at her, and her stomach flipped again. Feeling very odd, she left Mark and went back to cutting cheese into small cubes, as Kieran and Mark squabbled fondly about whether or not it was disgusting to eat sugar directly out of the box. There was something about being with both of them that was sweetly, calmly domestic, in a way she hadn't felt since she'd left home. Which was odd, because there was nothing ordinary at all about either Mark or Kieran, and nothing normal about how she felt about the two of them. She had, in fact, hardly seen either of them since they'd returned from Ferry. She'd spent her time in Emma's room, worried that Emma would wake up and she wouldn't be there. She'd slept on a mattress next to the bed, though she hadn't slept all that much. Emma had tossed restlessly night and day and called out over and over for Livy, for Drew and Ty and Mark, for her parents, and most often for Julian. There was another reason Christina wanted to be in the room with Emma, one that she had not admitted to anyone. In her incoherent state, Emma was calling out to Julian that she loved him, for him to come and hold her. Any of those statements might be written off as the love felt between Parabatai, but then again, they might not be. As a keeper of Emma and Julian's secret, Christina felt she owed it to them both to protect Emma's unconscious confidences. She knew Mark felt the same. He'd been with Julian, though he reported that Julian cried out much less. It was one of the few things Mark had said to her since they'd gotten back from Ferry. She'd been avoiding both Mark and Kieran, deliberately. Diego and Jaime were in prison, the consul was under house arrest, the Dearborns were still in power, and Emma and Julian were unconscious. She was far too frayed to deal with her mess of a love life at the moment. She hadn't realized till this moment quite how much she'd missed them.
Hello!
It was Tavi, bouncing into the kitchen. He'd been subdued the last few days while Julian had been sick, but he'd recovered with the admirable elasticity of children.
I'm supposed to carry the sandwiches, he added with the air of someone who had been given a task of great importance.
Mark gave him a plate of the donuts and another to Kieran, who shepherded Tavi out of the room in the manner of one growing used to being surrounded by a large family.
I wish I had a camera, Christina said after they left. A photograph of a haughty prince of Ferry carrying a plate of terrible donut sandwiches would be quite a memento.
My sandwiches are not terrible.
Mark leaned back against the counter with an easy grace. In blue jeans and a t-shirt, he looked entirely human, if you didn't notice sharply pointed ears.
You really care about him, don't you?
About Kieran?
Christina felt her pulse speed up, with nerves and the closeness to Mark. They had spoken only of surface things for days. The intimacy discussing their actual feelings was making her heart race.
Yes, I mean, you know that, don't you?
She felt herself blush.
You saw us kiss.
I did, Mark said.
I did not know what it meant to you, nor to Kieran, either.
He looked thoughtful.
It is easy to be carried away in Ferry.
I wanted to reassure you I was not angry or jealous. I am truly not, Christina.
All right, she said awkwardly. Thank you.
But what did it mean that he wasn't angry or jealous?
If what had happened with her and Kieran and Ferry had happened among shadow hunters, she would have considered it a declaration of interest.
Anne would have worried that Mark was upset. But it hadn't been, had it? It might have meant nothing more to Kieran than a handshake. She trailed a hand along the smooth top of the counter. She could not help but remember a conversation she had had with Mark once, here in the Institute. It felt so long ago. It came back to her like a lucid dream. There was nothing rehearsed about the look Mark gave her then. I meant it when I said you were beautiful. I want you, and Kieran would not mind.
You want me?
Yes, Mark said simply, and Christina looked away, suddenly very aware of how close his body was to hers, of the shape of his shoulders under his jacket. He was lovely, as fairies were lovely, with a sort of unearthliness, as quicksilver as moonlight on water. He didn't seem quite touchable, but she had just seen him kiss Kieran and knew better. You do not want to be wanted? In another time, the time before, Christina would have blushed. It's not the sort of compliment mortal women enjoy. But why not? Said Mark. Because it makes it sound like I'm a thing you want to use. And when you say Kieran would not mind, you make it sound like he would not mind because I do not matter.
That is very human, he said, to be jealous of a body but not a heart.
You see, I do not want a body without a heart, she said. A body without a heart. She could have both Mark and Kieran now, in the way that Mark had suggested so long ago. She could kiss them and be with them and bid them goodbye when they left her. Because they would.
Christina, Mark said, are you all right? You seem sad. I would have hoped to reassure you.
He touched the side of her face lightly, his fingers tracing the shape of her cheekbone.
I don't want to talk about this, Christina thought.
They had spent 3 days speaking of nothing important save Emma and Julian. Those 3 days and the peace of them felt delicate, as if too much discussion of reality and its harshness might shatter everything.
We don't have time to talk now, she said. Perhaps later. Let me say one thing, Mark spoke quietly. I have long been torn between two worlds. I thought I was a shadow hunter, told myself I was only that. But I have realized my ties to Fairy are stronger than I thought. I cannot leave half my blood, half my heart, in either world. I dream it might be possible to have both, but I know it cannot be.
Christina turned away so as not to see the look on his face. Mark would choose Fairy, she knew. Mark would choose Kieran. They had their history together, a great love in the past. They were both fairies, and though she had studied Fairy and yearned toward it with all her heart, it was not the same. They would be together because they belonged together, because they were beautiful together, and there would be pain for her when she lost them both. But that was the way for mortals who love the folk of Fairy. They always paid a heavy price.
It was, Emma discovered, not actually possible to hate donut sandwiches. Even if her arteries might pay for it someday down the line, she ate 3. Mark had placed them with care on platters, which sat in the middle of one of the big library tables. Something about the desire to please and the gesture touched Emma's heart. Everyone else was crowded around the long table, including Kieran, who sat quietly, his face blank, beside Mark. He wore a simple black shirt and linen pants. He looked nothing like he had the last time Emma had seen him, in the Unseelie Court, covered in blood and dirt, his face twisted with rage. Magnus looked different than he had the last time she'd seen him, too, and not in a good way. He had come down to the library, leaning heavily on Alec, his face gray and tight, sharply drawn with pain. He lay on a long couch by the table, a blanket around his shoulders. Despite the blanket and the warm weather, he shivered often. Every time he did, Alec would bend down over him and smooth his hair back or
draw the blankets up more tightly over his shoulders. And every time Alec did, Jace, sitting across the table beside Clary, would tense, his hands curling into useless fists. Because that was what being parabatai meant, Emma knew. Feeling someone else's pain as if it was your own. Magnus kept his eyes closed while Emma told the story of Thule. Julian interjected quietly when she forgot a detail or glossed over something he thought was necessary. He didn't push her, though, at the harder parts, when she had to talk about how Alec and Magnus had died, or about Isabel's last stand with the mortal sword, about Clary's death at Lilith's hands, and about Jace. His eyes widened incredulously when Emma spoke of the Jace who lived in Thule, who had been bound to Sebastian for so long he would never be free. Emma saw Clary reach over to grip his hand tightly, her eyes shining with tears the way they hadn't when her own death had been described. But the worst, of course, was describing Livy. Because while the other stories were horrors, knowing about Livy and Thule reminded them that there was a horror story in this world that they could neither change nor reverse. Drew, who had insisted on sitting at the table with everyone else, said nothing when they described Livy, but tears streaked silently down her cheeks. Mark went ashen, and Ty, who looked thinner than Emma remembered him, bitten down like a ragged fingernail, made no sound either. Kit, who was sitting beside him, tentatively put his hand over Ty's, where it lay on the table. Ty didn't react, though he didn't draw away from Kit either. Emma went on, because she had no choice but to go on. Her throat was aching badly by the time she finished. Gray-faced, Christina pushed a glass of water toward her, and she took it gratefully. A silence had fallen. No one seemed to know what to say. The only sound was the faint tinny chime of the music coming from Tabby's headphones as he played with a train set in the corner. They were Ty's headphones, really, but he put them gently on Tabby's head before Emma had started talking. "Poor Ash," Clary said. She was very pale. "He was my nephew. I mean, my brother was a monster, but..." "Ash saved me," Emma said. "He saved my life. And he said it was because he liked something I said about you. But he stayed because he wanted to stay in Thule. We offered to bring him back. He didn't want to come." Clary smiled tightly, her eyes sparkling with tears. "Thank you."
"Okay, let's talk about the important part." Magnus turned to Alec with a furious look on his face. "You killed yourself. Why would you do that?"
Alec looked startled. "That wasn't me," he pointed out. "It's an alternate universe, Magnus." Magnus grabbed Alec by the front of his shirt.
"If I die, you are not allowed to do anything like that. Who would take care of our kids? How could you do that to them?"
"We never had kids in that world," Alec protested.
"Where are Rafe and Max?" Emma whispered to Christina.
"Simon and Isabel are looking after them in New York. Alec checks in every day to see if Max is getting sick, but he seems fine so far," Christina whispered back.
"You are not allowed to hurt yourself under any circumstances," Magnus said, his voice gruff. "Do you understand that, Alexander?"
"I would never," Alec said softly, stroking Magnus's cheek.
Magnus clasped Alec's hand against his face.
"Never."
They all looked away, letting Magnus and Alec have their moment in privacy.
"I can see why you clawed at me when I tried to lift you up," Jace said to Emma. His golden eyes were dark with a regret she could only begin to understand. "When you first came through the portal, you were lying on the ground and you were bleeding, and I thought I should carry you to the infirmary, but you clawed at me and screamed like I was a monster."
"I don't remember it," Emma said honestly. "Jace, I know you're a completely different person than him, even if he did look like you. You can't feel bad or responsible for what someone who wasn't you did."
She turned to look at the rest of the table.
"The Thule versions of us aren't really us," she added. If you think of them as copies of you, it'll drive you crazy. That Livy, said Ty. She isn't mine. She isn't my Livy. Kit gave him a quick, startled look. The other Blackthorns looked puzzled, but though Julian raised his hand and lowered it again, as if he meant to protest, no one spoke. Perhaps it was better for Ty to know and to understand that Livy and Thule wasn't the same Livy he'd lost. Still, Emma thought of the letter, now in her pocket, and felt its weight, as if it were made of iron rather than paper and ink. It is terrible to believe that there can be such darkness so close to our own world, Mark said in a low voice. That we evaded this future by such a thin margin. It wasn't just chance, Mark, said Helen. It was because we had Clary. Because we had Jace. Because we had good people working together to make things right.
We have good people now, Magnus said. I have seen good people fall and fail in the past.
Magnus, you and Alec came here because you thought you might learn how to cure yourself, Helen began.
Because Katarina told us to, Magnus corrected. Believe me, I don't just pop out to California for my health under normal circumstances.
There's nothing normal about any of this, said Emma. Please, Helen said. I know this is an awful story, and we're all upset, but we have to focus.
Wait a second, Magnus said. Does this mean Max is turning into a tiny little demon? Do you know how many preschool waiting lists he's on? He'll never get into Little Red Schoolhouse now.
Aline threw a lamp. No one was expecting it, and the result was quite spectacular. It shattered against one of the dormer windows, and pieces of ceramic flew everywhere. She stood up, dusting off her hands.
Everyone, be quiet and listen to my wife, she said.
Magnus, I know you make jokes when you're scared. I remember Rome, she gave him a surprisingly sweet smile.
But we have to focus.
She turned to Helen.
Go on, honey. You're doing great.
She sat back down and folded her hands.
She definitely has a temper, Emma whispered to Christina.
I like it. Remind me to tell you about the frittata, Christina whispered back.
The important thing here, said Helen, is the blight. We didn't realize how important it was, that the blighted areas will become doorways for demons, that our warlocks, she looked at Magnus, will turn into demons. We have to close up these doorways and destroy the blight, and we can't expect any help from Idris.
Why? Said Julian. What's going on? What about Gia?
She's under house arrest in Idris, Aline said quietly. Horace is claiming he caught her meeting with fairies in Brosseland. She and Diana were arrested together, but Diana escaped.
We heard about some of this from Diana, said Clary. After she escaped from Idris, Gwyn brought her here, and she filled us in on what happened to her in Alicante.
Why isn't she still here? Asked Emma. Why did she leave?
Look at this. Mark pushed a piece of paper across the table. Julian and Emma leaned in to read it together. It was a message from the Clave. It said that Diana Rayburn was missing, believed to be under the influence of fairies. All institutes should be on lookout for her own good, and alert the Inquisitor as soon as she was spotted.
It's all nonsense, said Aline. My father says they're afraid of Diana's influence, and didn't want to just name her as a traitor. They're even lying about what happened to the Inquisitor. They're claiming he lost his arm in a battle with Downworlders when they were clearing them out of Idris.
His arm? Echoed Emma, bewildered.
Diana cut the Inquisitor's arm off, said Jace.
Emma upset her glass of water.
She did what?
He was threatening her, said Clary grimly. If Gwyn hadn't been around to get her out of Alicante, I don't know what would have happened.
It was badass, said Jace.
Well, good for her, said Emma.
That definitely calls for a large tapestry one of these days.
$50 says the Inquisitor develops a high-tech robot arm that shoots laser beams, said Kit.
Everyone looked at him.
It always happens in movies, he explained.
We're shadow hunters, said Julian. We're not high-tech. He sat back in his chair. Emma could see the bandages under his sleeve when he moved. You are in the cage.
She shivered.
We wanted Diana to stay here with us, but she thought that would make us a target, said Helen. She went to hide out with Gwen, though she's meant to check back in a few days.
Emma privately hoped Diana and Gwen were having a fabulous romantic time in a treetop or something. Diana deserved it.
It's awful all over, said Alec. The Downworlder registry is almost complete. With, of course, some notable exceptions.
He indicated Helen and Aline with a nod.
Quite a few Downworlders have managed to escape the registry, moi included, said Magnus. Alec threatened to kill me if I even considered putting my name on some sinister list of the cohort's undesirables.
There was no actual threatening, said Alec, in case anyone was wondering.
Well, all Downworlders have been removed from Idris, including the ones who were teachers at Shadowhunter Academy, Mark said. Rumors are running wild among Downworlders of sneak attacks by Shadowhunters. It's like the bad old days before the Accords, Magnus said.
The Iron Sisters have cut off communication with the cohort, said Aline. The Silent Brothers haven't said anything yet, but there was a statement from the Iron Sisters that they didn't accept Horus's authority. Horus is furious and keeps hounding them, especially because they have the shards of the Mortal Sword.
There's more, said Christina. Diego, Divya, and Rayan have been arrested, along with many others.
Her voice was strained.
They're throwing everyone in prison who disagrees with them, said Aline. In a small voice, Drew said, Jaime went to try to save his brother, but he wound up in prison too. We heard about it from Patrick Penhollow.
Emma looked at Christina, who was biting her lip unhappily.
Since we have no help from the Clave, and perhaps active opposition, what do we do? Julian said.
We do what Tessa told you to do in Thule, said Magnus.
I trust Tessa. I always have.
Just as you trusted Livy when you found her in Thule. They might not be exact copies of us, these alternate selves, but they're not so different, either.
So, we pour some of the water of Lake Lynn on the blighted areas, and save some to cure the warlocks, said Helen. The big problem being, how do we get to Lake Lynn, past the cohort guards who are all over Idris? And then, how do we get back out?
I will do it, Magnus said, sitting up. The blanket fell loosely around him. I will...
No, Alec said sharply. You are not risking yourself, Magnus, not in your condition.
Magnus opened his mouth to object. Clary leaned across the table, her eyes entreating.
Please, Magnus. You've helped us so many times. Let us help you.
How?
Magnus said gruffly.
Jace rose to his feet. We'll go to Idris. Clary stood up too. She only reached to Jace's bicep, but her determination was clear.
I can create portals. We can't get into Alicante, but we don't need to. Just into Idris. We'll go to Lake Lynn, then Brosalind, and get back as fast as we can. We'll go as many times as we need to so we can get enough water.
There are guards patrolling all over Idris, said Helen. You'll need to be armed and prepared.
Then we'll start getting armed now, Jace winked at Magnus. Prepare to be helped, Warlock, whether you like it or not.
Not, Magnus grumbled, subsiding into his blanket, but he was smiling.
And the look Alec gave Jace and Clary was more eloquent than any speech.
Wait, Aline held up a hand. She was shuffling through a pile of papers on the table.
I've got the schedules of the Idris patrols here. They're sweeping different locations in Idris to make sure they're clear of Downworlders.
She spoke the words with distaste.
They're going to Lake Lynn today and tonight, she looked up. You can't go now.
We can deal with some guards, Jace said.
No, said Magnus. It's too dangerous. You can deal with 10 guards or 20, but it's going to be 50 or 100.
100, said Helen, looking over Aline's shoulder. At least.
I won't let you take the risk, Magnus said. I'll wear myself out using my magic to drag you back.
Magnus!
Clary sounded appalled.
What does the schedule say? Asked Julian. When can they go?
Tomorrow, dawn, said Aline. They should have dispersed by then.
She set the papers down.
I know it's not ideal, but it's what we need to do. We'll spend a day setting up and getting you ready, making sure everything goes without a hitch. There was a general hubbub as everyone offered to pitch in, claiming one responsibility or another. Emma and Christina were going to talk to Katerina about the possible cure. Mark and Julian were going to check maps of Brosselin to find where the areas of blight were. Clary and Jace were going to gather up their gear and weapons, and Helen and Aline were going to try to find out exactly when the patrol would be moving from Lake Lynn to Brosselin Forest. Ty and Kit, meanwhile, would start putting together lists of local warlocks who might need lake water when it was retrieved. As everyone gathered up the things, Ty went over to the corner where Tavi was playing and knelt down to hand him a small train. Amid the confusion, Emma slipped after him. He appeared to have offered the train as a trade for his headphones. "Ty," Emma said, crouching down. Tavi was busy turning trains upside down. "I have to give you something."
"What kind of thing?"
He sounded puzzled. She hesitated, then drew the envelope from her pocket.
"It's a letter," she said, "from the Livy in the other dimension, in Thule. We told her about you, and she wanted to write something for you to read. I haven't looked at it," she said. "It's just for you."
Ty stood up. He was graceful as a hollow-boned bird and looked as light and fragile. "She's not my Livy."
"I know," Emma said.
She couldn't stop looking at his hands. His knuckles were raw and red. Her Julian would have noticed that already and been moving heaven and earth to find out what happened.
"And you don't have to read it, but it's yours. And I think you should have it."
She paused. "After all, it did come from a pretty long way away." A look passed over his face that she couldn't quite decipher. He took it, though, and folded it up inside his jacket.
"Thanks,"
he said, and went across the room to join Kit in the Downworlders Warlocks section, where Kit was struggling with several heavy books.
"Don't,"
she heard Christina say, and looked around in surprise. She didn't see Christina anywhere, but that had definitely been her voice. She glanced around. Tavi was absorbed in his train, and everyone else was hurrying to and fro.
"Kieran, I know you are worried, but you didn't speak a word through the whole meeting."
"Oh, dear," Emma thought. She realized that Christina's voice was coming from the other side of a bookcase, and that Christina and Kieran had no idea she was there. If she tried to leave, though, they'd know immediately. "These are shadow hunts of politics," Kieran said. There was something in his voice, Emma thought, something different.
"It is not something I understand. It is not my fight."
"It is your fight," Christina replied.
Emma had rarely heard her speak with such intensity.
"You fight for what you love. We all do."
She hesitated.
"Your heart is hidden, but I know you love Mark. I know you love Fairy. Fight for that, Kieran."
"Christina,"
Kieran began, but Christina had already hurried away. She emerged from the other side of the bookcase and saw Emma immediately. She looked surprised and guilty and hurried quickly from the room. Kieran started to follow but stopped halfway across the room and leaned his hands on the table, bowing his head. Emma started to edge out from behind the bookcase, hoping to creep to the door unnoticed. She should have known better than to try to sneak by a fairy, she realized ruefully. Kieran looked up at the first tap of his shoes on the polished wood floor.
"Emma?" "Just going," she said. "Don't mind me."
"But I wish to mind you," he said, coming out from behind the table. He was all graceful angles, pallor and darkness. Emma supposed she could see what drew Christina to him.
"I have had cause to understand how much pain I brought to you when you were whipped by Irloth," he said. "I never desired that outcome, yet I did cause it. I cannot change that, but I can offer my sincere regrets and swear myself to accomplish any task that you set me."
Emma had not been expecting this. "Any task? Like you'd be willing to learn to hula dance?"
"Is that a torture of your people?" said Kieran.
"Then yes, I would submit to it, for your sake." Sadly, Emma put aside the thought of Kieran in a grass skirt.
"You fought on our side in the Unseelie Court," she said. "You brought Mark and Christina back safely with you, and they mean everything to me. You've proven yourself a true friend, Kieran."
You have my forgiveness, and you don't need to do anything else to earn it. He actually blushed, a touch of color warming his pale cheeks.
That is not what a fairy would say.
It's what I would say,
Emma said cheerfully. Kieran strode toward the door, where he paused and turned to her.
I have known how Christine loves you, and I understand why. If you had been born a fairy, you would be a great knight at the court. You are one of the bravest people I have ever known.
Emma stammered a thank you, but Kieran was already gone, like a shadow melting into the forest. She stared after him, realizing what it was she'd heard earlier in the way he said Christina's name, as if it were a torment that he adored. She had never heard him speak any name but Mark's that way before.
Is there anything you want to talk to me about? Magnus asked as Julian prepared to leave the library.
He'd thought Magnus was asleep. He was leaning back on his couch, his eyes closed. There were deep shadows beneath them, the kind that came with multiple sleepless nights.
No, Julian tensed all over.
He thought of the words cut into the skin of his arm. He knew if he showed them to Magnus, the warlock would want to take the spell off him immediately, and Magnus was too weak for that. The effort might kill him. He also knew his reaction to the thought of Magnus dying was off-kilter and wrong. It was dulled down, flattened. He didn't want Magnus to die, but he knew he should feel more than not wanting, just as he should have felt more than the flat relief at being reunited with his siblings. And he knew he should feel more when he saw Emma. It was as if a white space of nothingness had been cut out all around her, and when he stepped into it, everything went blank. It was difficult to even speak. It was worse than it had been before, he thought. Somehow, his emotions were even more damped down than they had been before Thule. He felt despair. But it was dull and distant, too. It made him want to grip the blade of a knife just to feel anything at all.
I suppose you wouldn't, Magnus said, given that you probably don't feel much.
His cat eyes glittered.
I shouldn't have put that spell on you. I regret it.
Don't, Julian said. But he wasn't sure if he meant don't say that to me or don't regret it. His emotions were too distant for him to reach. He did know he wanted to stop talking to Magnus now, and he went out into the corridor, tense and breathless.
Jules!
He turned around and saw Ty coming toward him along the hallway. The distant part of himself said Ty looked different. His mind scrambled for the words, bruised, hurt, fragile, and couldn't hold them.
Can I talk to you?
Askew, he thought. He looks atypical for Ty. He stopped trying to find words and followed Ty into one of the vacant bedrooms along the hall, where Ty closed the door behind them, turned around, and threw his arms around Julian without a word of warning. It was awful. Not because being hugged by Ty was awful. It was nice, as much as Julian could sense that it was nice. His brain said, "This is your blood, your family." And his arms went up automatically to hug Ty back. His brother was fragile in his arms, all soft hair and sharp bones, as if he were made out of seashells and dandelion fluff and strung together with fine silk thread.
I'm glad you're back,
Ty said in a muffled voice. He pressed his head against Julian's shoulder, and his headphones had tilted sideways. Ty reached up automatically to right them.
I was afraid we'd never all be back together again.
But we are back together, Julian said.
Ty leaned back a little, his hands gripping the front of Julian's jacket.
I want you to know I'm sorry,
he said, in the rushed tones of someone who had practiced a speech for a long time.
At Livy's funeral, I climbed the pyre, and you cut up your hands coming after me, and I thought maybe you left because you didn't want to deal with me.
Something in Julian's head was screaming. Screaming that he loved his little brother more than he loved almost anything else on earth. Screaming that Ty rarely reached out like this, rarely instigated physical contact with Julian like this.
But Julian, who felt very far away, was scrambling desperately, wanting to react correctly, wanting to give Ty what he needed so he could recover from Libby's death and not be wrecked or lost. But it was like pounding on soundproofed glass. The Julian he was now couldn't hear. The silence of his heart was almost as profound as the silence he felt around Emma.
"That's not it," he said. "I mean, that wasn't it. We left because of the Inquisitor." Distant Julian was bruising his hands, slamming them against the glass. This Julian struggled for words and said, "It's not your fault."
"Okay," Ty said. "I have a plan. A plan to fix everything."
"Good," Julian said.
And Ty looked surprised, but he didn't see it. He was scrambling to hold on, to try to find the right words, the feeling words to say to Ty, who had thought Julian had gone away because he was angry.
"I'm sure you have a great plan. I trust you."
He let go of Ty and turned toward the door. Better to be done than to risk saying the wrong thing. He would be all right as soon as the spell was off him. He could talk to Ty then.
"Jules?"
Ty said. He stood uncertainly by the arm of the sofa, fiddling with the cord of his headphones.
"Do you want to know?"
"It's great you're doing better, Ty," Julian said, not looking at Ty's face, his eloquently moving hands. It was only a few seconds, but by the time Julian made it out into the hallway, he was breathing as hard as if he had escaped from a monster.
Chapter 23. That Winds May Be. Diego was starting to be seriously worried about Jaime. It was hard to tell how many days the brothers had been in the guards' prisons. They could only hear murmurs from the other cells. The thick stone walls muffled noise deliberately to prevent communication among the prisoners. They hadn't seen Zara again either. The only people who came to their cell were the guards who brought occasional meals. Sometimes Diego would beg the guards, dressed in the dark blue and gold of guard watchmen, to bring him a steely or medicine for his brother, but they always ignored him. He thought bitterly that it was exactly Dearborn's kind of clever to make sure the watchmen who worked in the guard were suborned to the cohort's cause. Jaime moved restlessly on the pile of clothes and straw Diego had managed to cobble together as a bed. He donated his own sweater and sat shivering in his light undershirt. Still, he wished there was something more he could do. Jaime was flushed, his skin tight-looking and shiny with fever.
"I swear I saw her last night," he murmured.
"Who?" said Diego. He sat with his back to the cold stone wall, close enough to touch his brother if Jaime needed him.
"Zara?"
Jaime's eyes were closed.
"The consul. She was wearing her robes. She looked at me, and she shook her head, like she thought I shouldn't be in here."
"You shouldn't. You're barely 17. Diego had done what he could to clean Jaime up after Zara had dumped him in the cell. Most of his wounds were shallow cuts, and he had two broken fingers, but there was one deep, dangerous wound on his shoulder. Over the past days, it had puffed up and turned red. Diego felt rageful. Shadow hunters didn't die of infections. They were healed by Irazis, or they died in battle in a blaze of glory. Not like this, of fever on a bed of rags and straw. Jaime smiled his crooked smile.
"Don't feel sorry for me," he said. "You got the worst end of the deal. I got to run all over the world with the Eternidad. You had to romance Zara."
"Jaime." Jaime wheezed a cough.
"I hope you pulled out one of your famous Diego Rosales moves, like winning her a big stuffed animal at a carnival."
"Jaime, we must be serious." Jaime's wide, dark eyes opened.
"My dying wish is that we not be serious."
Diego sat up angrily.
"You are not dying, and we need to talk about Christina."
That got Jaime's attention. He struggled into a sitting position,
I have been thinking about Christina. Zara doesn't know that she has the Eternidad, the heirloom. And there is no reason for her ever to know.
We could try to figure out a way to warn Christina. Tell her to abandon the heirloom somewhere. Give it to someone else. We'll give her a head start.
No.
Jaime's eyes glittered with fever.
Absolutely not. If we told Zara that Christina had it, she'd torture Christina to get the information just like she tortured me. Even if it had been thrown into the depths of the ocean, Zara wouldn't care. She would torture Christina regardless. Zara can't know who has it.
What if we told Christina to give it to Zara? Diego said slowly.
We can't. Would you really want the Corps to get their hands on it? We don't even understand everything it does.
He reached out and took Diego's hand in his fever-hot one. His fingers felt as thin as they had when he was 10.
I will be okay, he said. Please, do not do any of these things for me.
There was a clang as Zara appeared in the corridor, followed by the hunched figure of Anoush Joshi. Cortana glimmered at her hip. The sight annoyed Diego. A blade like Cortana should be worn strapped to the back. Zara cared more about showing off the sword than she did about having such a special weapon. Anoush carried a tray with two bowls of the usual glop on it. Kneeling, he slid it through the low gap in the bottom of the cell door.
How can someone as wonderful as Divya have such a terrible cousin? Diego thought.
That's right, Anoush, Zara said, prowling around her companion. This is your punishment for deserting us in the forest, bringing slop to our worst, smelliest prisoners. She sneered at Diego. Your brother doesn't look too good. Feverish, I think.
Changed your mind yet?
Nobody's changed their mind, Zara, Jaime said.
Zara ignored him, looking at Diego. He could tell her what she wanted to know and trade Jaime's safety for the heirloom. The part of him that was a big brother that had always protected Jaime and treated him to do it. But strangely, in the moment, he remembered Kieran saying,
You decide you will find a solution when the time comes, but when the worst happens, you find yourself unprepared.
He could save Jaime in the moment, but he understood Zara well enough to know that that wouldn't mean Jaime and Diego would walk free. If the cohort got their way, no one would ever walk free again.
Jaime is correct, Diego said. No one has changed their mind.
Zara rolled her eyes. Fine. I'll see you later. She stalked away, Anoush hurrying like a dispirited shadow in her wake. Emma sat beside Christina on the office desk and drank in the view. The walls were glass, and through them she could see the ocean on one side and the mountains on the other. It felt as if the colors of the world had been restored to her after the darkness of Thule. The sea seemed to sing blues and silvers, golds and greens. The desert, too, glowed with green, bright and dull, rich terracotta sand and dirt, and deep purple shadows between the hills. Christina took a small vial out of her pocket, made of thick blue glass. She unstoppered it and held it up to the light. Nothing happened. Emma looked at Christina sideways.
It always takes a bit of time, Christina said reassuringly. I heard you in the Unseelie Court, Emma said. You said that it wasn't the ley lines, that it was the blight. You figured it out, didn't you? What was causing the warlock sickness?
Christina turned the vial around.
I suspected it, but I wasn't totally sure.
I knew the blight in Brosseland was the same as the blight in Faerie, but when I realized the king was causing them both, that he wanted to poison our world, I realized it might be what was hurting the warlocks.
And Katerina knows?
I told her when we got back. She said she'd look into it.
Smoke began to stream out of the vial, gray-white and opaque. It slowly shaped itself into a slightly distorted scene, wavering at the edges. They were looking at Tessa in a loose blue dress, a stone wall visible behind her.
Tessa, Emma said,
Tessa, Christina said. Is Katerina there as well?
Tessa tried to smile, but it wavered.
Last night, Katerina fell into a sleep that we haven't been able to wake her from. She is very ill.
Christina murmured in sympathy. Emma couldn't stop staring at Tessa. She looked so different. Not older or younger, but more alive. She had not realized how much Thule Tessa's emotions had seemed deadened, as if she had long ago given up on having them. And this Tessa, Emma remembered, was pregnant. It wasn't visible yet, though Tessa did rest one hand with light protectiveness on her belly as she spoke.
Before Katerina fell into unconsciousness, Tessa said, she told me that she thought Christina was right about the blight. We have some samples of it here, and we've been studying them, but I fear we will be too late to save Magnus and Katerina, and so many others. Her eyes were bright with tears.
Emma sprang to reassure her.
We think we might have the answer, she said, and scrambled to tell her story again, ending it on her meeting with Tessa in the cave.
There seemed no reason to tell her now what had come after that.
I told you this? Tessa seemed astonished. A me that you encountered in another world?
I know it sounds hard to believe. You were living in that cave, the big one up by Staircase Beach. You had church with you.
That does sound right, Tessa seemed dazed.
What's the plan? I can help you, though there are a few other warlocks well enough to join me.
No, it's all right, Christina said. Jason and Clary are going.
Tessa frowned. That seems dangerous.
Aline found the time tomorrow when she thinks there won't be guards at Lake Lynn, said Christina. They're going to leave at dawn.
I suppose danger can never be avoided for Nephilim, said Tessa. She glanced at Christina. Could Emma and I speak for a moment, alone, please?
Christina blinked in surprise, then hopped down from the desk.
Of course.
She bumped Emma's shoulder companionably as she headed out the door, and then Emma was alone in the office with a wavering but determined-looking Tessa.
Emma, Tessa said as soon as the door had shut behind Christina, I wanted to talk to you about Kit Herondale.
Kit picked his way across the sand, his sneakers already wet where the incoming tide had caught him unawares. It was the first time he'd been down to the beach near the Institute without Ty. He felt almost guilty, though when he told Ty he was taking a walk, Ty had just nodded and said he'd see him later. Kit knew Ty wanted to talk to Julian, and he didn't want to interrupt anyway. There was something restful about this place, where the sea met the shore. Kit had learned long ago in the Shadow Market that there were in-between spaces in the world, where it was easier to do certain kinds of magic. The middle of bridges, caves between the earth and the underworld, borderlands between the seely and unseely courts, and the Shadow Market itself between the downworld and the mundane. The Tide Line was a place like that, and because of that, it felt like home. It reminded him of an old song he remembered someone else singing to him. It must have been his father, though he always remembered it in a woman's voice.
Tell him to buy me an acre of land, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, between the salt water and the sea sand. Then he shall be a true love of mine.
That's a very, very old song, said a voice. Kit almost tumbled off the rock he'd been clambering over. The sky was deep blue, studded with white clouds, and standing above him on a heap of rocks was Shade. He wore a ragged navy suit with a stitched collar and cuffs, his green skin a stark contrast. How do you know it? Kit, who hadn't even realized he'd been humming the tune, shrugged.
Shade had left off his usual hood. His green face was lined and good-humored, his hair curly and white. Small horns protruded from his temples, curling inward like seashells. Something about him struck Kit as a little odd.
Heard it in the market.
What are you doing out and about without your shadow?
Ty is not my shadow, said Kit crossly.
My apologies. I suppose you're his.
Shade's eyes were solemn. Have you come to tell me of the progress you've made in your foolish plan to raise his sister from the dead? It wasn't why Kit had come down here, but he found himself telling Shade anyway. About Emma's and Julian's return, though he made no mention of Thule, and the visits they'd made to the Shadow Market in the ensuing chaos, no one noticing they were gone. Julian, usually the most eagle-eyed older brother in the world, had been unconscious, and even today he'd seemed unfocused and groggy. "You've done better than I thought you would," Shade said grudgingly, looking out to the sea. "Still, you've mostly gotten the easy stuff. There's still some objects that ought to trip you up."
"You sound like you want us to fail," said Kit.
"Of course I do," Shade barked. "You shouldn't be messing around with necromancy. It never does anyone any good." Kit backed up until his heels hit the surf.
"Then why are you helping us?"
"Look, there's a reason I'm here," said Shade. "Yeah, Hypatia passed on Tiberius's message to me. But I was headed to the cave anyway, to keep an eye on you."
"On me?"
"Yes, you. Did you really think I was sticking around and helping you with your dumb necromancy just as a favor to Hypatia? We're not that close. Jem's the one who asked me to look after you. The whole Carstairs, oh, the Herondale's business, you know."
It was weird to Kit, the idea that someone would be worried about protecting him just because of his last name.
"Okay, but why are you helping us with the spell stuff?"
"Because I said I would protect you, and I will."
"Your tie is stubborn, like the Blackthorns are all stubborn. And you're even stubborner. If I didn't help you two, some other warlock would. Someone who didn't care if you both got hurt. And no, I haven't told anyone about it."
"A lot of the other warlocks are sick," Kit said, realizing that this was what had seemed odd about Shade. He didn't look even a little bit ill.
"And I might get sick too, eventually. But there will always be unscrupulous magic users. What are you looking all cross-eyed about, boy?"
"I guess I was thinking that you didn't know they found a cure for the warlock plague," said Kit, "up at the Institute." It was the first time he'd ever seen the warlock look genuinely surprised.
"The Nephilim? Found a cure for the warlock illness?"
Kit thought back on the way he'd been introduced to the idea of shadow hunters. Not as people, but as a vicious, holier-than-thou army of true believers. As if they were all like Horace Dearborn, and none were like Julian Blackthorne or Christina Rosales. Or like Alec Lightwood, patiently holding a glass of water with a straw in it so his sick warlock boyfriend could drink.
"Yes," he said. "Jace and Clary are going to retrieve it. I'll make sure you get some."
Shade's face twisted, and he turned so Kit couldn't see his expression.
"If you insist," he said gruffly. "But make sure Katarina Loss gets it first. And Magnus Bane. I've got some protections. I'll be fine for a good long while."
"Magnus will be the first to get it, don't worry," said Kit. "He's at the Institute now." At that, Shade spun back around.
"Magnus is here."
He glanced up at the Institute where it gleamed like a legendary castle on a hill.
"When he's well, tell him I'm in the staircase beach cave. Just as he asked," he said. "Tell him Ragnar says hello."
Ragnar Shade?
Whatever force blessed people with good names had passed this poor guy over, Kit thought. He turned his head back up the path from the beach to the highway. The sand stretched out before him in a shimmering crescent, the tide line touched with silver.
"Christopher," said Shade, and Kit paused, surprised at the sound of the name hardly anyone ever called him. "Your father," Shade began, and hesitated. "Your father wasn't a Herondale." Kit froze. In that moment, he had a sudden terror that it had all been a mistake. He wasn't a shadow hunter. He didn't belong here. He would be taken away from all of it, from Ty, from everyone.
"Your mother," said Shade, "she was the Herondale. And an unusual one. You want to look into your mother?" Relief punched through Kit like a blow. A few weeks ago, he would have been delighted to have been told he wasn't Nephilim, Now it seemed like the worst fate he could imagine. "What was her name?" he said. "Shade, what was my mother's name?" But the warlock had jumped down from his rock and was walking away. The sound of the waves and tide swallowed up Kit's words, and Shade didn't turn around.
Killer dolls, sinister woodsmen, eyeless ghouls, and graveyards full of mist. Drew would have listed those as her top favorite things about asylum frozen fear, but they didn't seem to interest Kieran much. He sprawled on the other side of the couch, gazing moodily into space, even when people on screen started screaming.
"This is my favorite part," said Drew,
part of her mind on nibbling popcorn, the other part on whether or not Kieran was imagining himself in a different, peaceful place, maybe a beach. She didn't quite know how she'd inherited him after the meeting, just that they seemed to be the two people who hadn't been given a task to do. She'd escaped to the den, and a few moments later Kieran had appeared, flopped down on the sofa, and picked up a calendar of fluffy cats that someone, okay, her, had left around.
"The bit where he steps on the voodoo doll, and it explodes into blood, and..."
"This manner of marking the passage of time is a marvel," said Kieran. "When you're done with one kitten, there is another kitten. By the next winter solstice, you will have seen 12 full kittens. One of them is in a glass."
"In December, there are 3 kittens in a basket," Drew said. "But you should really watch the movie."
Kieran set the calendar down and gazed at the screen in some puzzlement. Then he sighed.
"I just don't understand," he said. "I love them both, but it seems as if they cannot understand that. As if it is a torment or an insult."
Drew hit the mute button and put down the remote.
Finally, she thought, someone was talking to her like an adult.
Admittedly, Kieran wasn't making a lot of sense, but still.
"Shadowhunters are slow to love," she said. "But once we love forever."
It was something she remembered Helen having said to her once, maybe at her wedding. Kieran blinked and focused in on her, as if she'd said something clever.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, that is true. I must trust in Mark's love. But Christina, she has never said she loves me, and they both feel so far away just now."
"Everyone feels far away just now," Drew said, thinking of how lonely the past few days had been.
"But that's because they're worried. When they get worried, they pull inside themselves, and sometimes they forget you're here."
She glanced down at her popcorn.
"But it doesn't mean they don't care."
Kieran leaned an elbow on his knee.
"So what do I do, Drusilla?" Drusilla said, "don't remain silent about what you want, or you may never get it."
"You are very wise," Kieran said gravely.
"Well," said Drew. "I actually saw that on a mug. Mugs in this world are very wise."
Drew wasn't entirely sure if Kieran was smiling or not, but by the way he sat back and crossed his arms, she sensed he was done with questions. She turned the TV volume back on. Emma pulled out the pushpins, carefully taking down the different colored string, the old newspaper clippings, the photos curling at the edges. Each one representing a clue, or what she'd thought was a clue, to the secret of her parents' deaths. Who had killed them? Why had they died as they had? Now Emma knew the answers. She had asked Julian some time ago what she would do with all the evidence she'd collected, but he'd indicated that it was her decision. He'd always called it her wall of crazy, but in a lot of ways, Emma thought of it as a wall of sanity. Because creating it had kept her sane during a time where she'd felt helpless, overwhelmed with missing her parents and the sure support of their love.
"This was for you, Mom and Dad," she thought, dumping the last of the photos into a shoebox. "I know what happened to you now, and the person who killed you is dead. Maybe that makes a difference, maybe not. I know it doesn't mean I miss you any less."
She wondered if she should say more, that revenge wasn't the panacea she had hoped for,
that in fact she was a little frightened of it now. She knew how powerful it was, how it drove you. In Thule, she had seen